Richard is a core faculty member of Duke College of California in the School of Sustainability and a research fellow at the Closed Carbon Institute. He is the author of seven books, including The Party's Over, Power Down, and The Oil Depletion Protocol, which is his latest book. And it will be just now being released in time for this tour, so you're very fortunate, and copies are available. He's widely acknowledged as one of the world's foremost peak oil educators. And I want to say that Richard's actually a Renaissance man, because he not only talks about intellectual ideas and stimulates the brain cells, he's also a very good and able violinist, and he illustrates children's books in the free time that he doesn't have any longer.
Well, thanks very much. It's certainly a pleasure to be here in Western Australia. And David Holmgren and I are going to be doing a bit of a bad news, good news act tonight. And it's my pleasure to be the bearer of the bad news, which of course relates to the subject of peak oil. Now, I'll be speaking of oil primarily as a source of energy. Of course, we use it for other purposes as well, but it's been a marvelous source of energy for the past 150 years, and energy is something that's absolutely essential to our existence. In fact, nothing happens without energy, quite literally, and we human beings are energy junkies, just as every other species is and always has been. It's been our particular genius as human beings to find ways of harvesting energy from our environments other than just through food, which other animals are confined to. And we started doing that tens of thousands of years ago when we started using fire in various ways. And then with the invention of agriculture and domestication of animals, we were able to harness the muscle power of animals. And then water mills and windmills. With all of these, there was typically just a very small energy profit from the exercise. For example, with horses, we have to feed horses grain. We can use their muscle power, but typically in most countries 100 years ago, something like a quarter of cropland had to be set aside for growing food for draft animals. So it took energy to get energy, and there was just a bit of energy profit that made the exercise worthwhile. But that thin margin of energy profit was enough to enable us to create complex societies. Now, 150, 200 years ago, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, all of that changed. I used to think of the Industrial Revolution as being all about the invention of new technologies, which it certainly was, but those new technologies came about because we had a marvelous new energy source with which to run them, namely fossil fuels. And that's changed literally everything. Arguably, the most important of the fossil fuels was oil. And we started extracting oil back in the 1860s, particularly in North America. A fellow by the name of Edwin Drake had the idea that you could drill wells for oil, for rock oil, which is the literal translation of the word petroleum, just as people were already drilling wells for water. And of course, he was wonderfully successful. The problem from then on was having too much of the stuff. And that's really been the problem almost right up to the present day. And so we've had Standard Oil Corporation, we had the Texas Railroad Commission, and now we have OPEC, whose sole purpose is to constrain production so as to keep prices from plummeting. Well, we don't have that problem anymore, but more of that later. So this oil industry grew up beginning in the 1860s with John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. Now, here we are in the 2000s, this is a picture of the world's largest single oil-producing field, Ghawar in Saudi Arabia, that produces something like 5 million barrels a day. So we've come a great distance, and we've managed to accomplish a great deal. Now, one of the sort of side effects of our energy boon from fossil fuels has been our ability to support a larger and larger human population. And it's really quite extraordinary to see just how successful we've been as a species over the past couple of hundred years as a result of this tremendous energy subsidy from fossil fuels, using fossil fuels to grow more food, to pump water, irrigation water, to feed and house people in places where they otherwise wouldn't be able to live. But as an ecologist looking at this graph, it looks somewhat familiar, and maybe one analogy might be this. I happen to come from wine country in Northern California, and we do a lot of this here, adding yeast to a sugar solution, namely grape juice. And of course, what happens is that the yeast consume the sugar and the grape juice, and then they also give off a toxin, which is alcohol, which of course the whole point of the exercise as far as we're concerned, which then poisons the yeast, and they all die off. Now, this is kind of similar to what we're doing with fossil fuels in a way. We're consuming this resource and then giving off a toxin, an effluent into the environment that's poisoning not only ourselves but the global climate, which to my mind raises a very important question. And I think this is the question we will be answering over the course of this century. So far, it doesn't look very good. Now, fossil fuels, as I said earlier, have given us a tremendous economic benefit, and this is just one way of sort of understanding and gauging that. This is the work done in the U.S. economy over time. Back in 1850, most of the work was being done by muscle power, about 65% by the muscles of domesticated animals, about 18% by human muscles. Only about 17 or 18% by fuel-fed machinery. Now, by 1960, virtually everything's being done by machines. Now, that doesn't mean people aren't working anymore. It just means that the contribution of human muscle power is insignificant in comparison with the power of our machines. Now, this has all been wonderful. It's been the greatest party in human history. But there are some disturbing signs now appearing on the horizon. The most obvious one simply being the fact that the price of oil has been skyrocketing over the last 3 or 4 years. This, of course, is the spot price of oil. But what many people haven't been paying as much attention to is the 5-year futures price. And this is rather interesting because looking back through the 1990s, even when the spot price has gone down to close to $10 as it did around 1999, or when it's shot up to $40, the long-term investors who buy the futures, oil futures, 60-month contracts, have been betting that the price will revert to its mean at about $20 a barrel. Well, that's changed within the last couple of years, and now the 5-year futures price is also up to about $70. So the smart money is telling us that we'll never see $20 a barrel oil ever again, or maybe even $50 oil ever again. What's going on here? Well, of course, the answer to that question really is peak oil. Now, very often this is described as the peak oil theory, which is fair enough, I guess, but really I think it should be just described as peak oil observation, because that's more of what it is. We've been watching peak oil happen for the last 35 years at least. And the first place where it really took a bite was in the U.S., which was the world's foremost oil-producing nation for decades. In fact, during the early part of the 20th century, it was the world's foremost oil-exporting nation. It was the Saudi Arabia of the early 20th century. So what happened there? Well, discovery of oil reached its peak right around 1930. And then 40 years later, extraction of oil reached a peak and began its inexorable decline right around 1970. And this was an event that, while it was little noted at the time and still is not discussed very much in newspapers and magazines, it's not taught in history courses to any great extent in the U.S., it nevertheless was an important historic turning point in this nation's history. Think about how the U.S. economy has shifted since then. It used to be that the U.S. was loaning money to the rest of the world. It was the world's manufacturing engine. And we were exporting manufactured goods to the rest of the world and earning foreign exchange income. Today, the U.S. is borrowing $2 billion every day just to finance its trade deficit. And 40% of that trade deficit comes just from importing oil. And we import almost two-thirds of what we use. Think of how U.S. foreign policy has changed as a result of this. We had the Carter Doctrine in 1979, which said that henceforth, the U.S. would use its military to defend its access to the oil resources of the Middle East. So a lot has changed since U.S. oil production peaked, and many of those changes are not very happy ones. Well, the same thing is happening in country after country around the world. Oil producing countries going through their own oil production peaks. The North Sea is a great example because their discoveries mostly took place in the late 1960s and the 1970s, exactly the time when most industrialized nations were very concerned about the fact that so much of the world's oil resources were concentrated in the Middle East, and we just had the embargo of the OPEC nations in the Middle East against the U.S. and some European countries. So finding lots of light, sweet crude oil in these non-Middle Eastern countries, Great Britain, Denmark, and Norway, this was great news. So we went about extracting that oil using all the latest technology, with the consequence that oil extraction peaked only 30 years after the peak of discovery. And it's in steep decline in all three of these countries now, something like 10% a year or more in some cases. Other countries, well, these are non-OPEC countries that are in decline. Well, here's Australia, right, first on the list. UK, we've already talked about, Pakistan, Argentina, Congo, New Zealand, Yemen, Tunisia, Gabon, Norway, Colombia, and OPEC countries in the same boat, including Indonesia, which was an extremely important oil exporting country throughout the 20th century, now is so far into decline that Indonesia has actually become a net oil importer, despite the fact that it's still a member of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Figure that out. Qatar, Venezuela, Iran, Nigeria, Algeria. Now, Saudi Arabia is an interesting case because, of course, Saudi officials insist that they'll be able to continue increasing their rate of extraction until mid-century. A lot of questions are being raised by independent analysts about that, especially Matthew Simmons, the founder of Simmons & Company Energy Investment Bank, who's suggested that the Saudi efforts at maximizing production from their main oil fields is actually resulting in a peak occurring just about now. Remember, in the U.S., discovery peaked about 40 years before extraction peaked. And, of course, in every oil-producing region, we're going to see discovery peaking before extraction peaks. Well, how are we doing for the world as a whole? Because that's what really matters. That's what peak oil is about. It's about when the world as a whole reaches its maximum rate of production. So, is the world still discovering lots of oil? Well, not really. We hit our maximum rate of discoveries back in 1964. It's been declining ever since in kind of a sawtooth fashion. We had a couple of good years in 1999 and 2000, but in years since then, it's gotten still worse, And the rates of discovery now are back to about what they were in the early 1920s. Before 1980, we were discovering more oil every year than we extracted. Since 1980, we've been extracting more oil every year than we discover. And this is what it's likely to look like when all is said and done. This is a chart published by ASPO, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. And by the way, there is an ASPO chapter right here in Western Australia that's very active. It shows a lot of interesting things. Some good history here. We see how we became more and more dependent on oil during the first part of the 20th century. Then with the first oil shock, there's a bit of a hiccup. And then the second oil shock of 1979 with the fall of the Shah of Iran and the beginning of the Iran-Iraq war, really a substantial decline in our oil dependence, partly because of the massive increase in prices, but also because many industrialized nations took steps to use oil much more efficiently. In the U.S., speed limits went down from 75 miles an hour to 55 on interstate highways. The government started mandating the production of more fuel-efficient vehicles, and people spontaneously started buying more fuel-efficient vehicles just because the prices of petrol were so high. But then in the mid-1980s, when prices went back down, of course, many of those efforts fell by the wayside, and we became that much more dependent. Now, this chart also shows the difference between regular conventional oil, the stuff down here, and non-conventional liquid hydrocarbons, including natural gas liquids, deep water oil, polar oil, tar sands, and all of those sorts of things. And as you can see, we're using more and more of the non-conventional stuff all the time, even though it's all much more expensive to produce. That tells us something right there. Well, according to ASPO, it's likely we'll see global peak sometime within the next 4 or 5 years. Now, why are they saying that? Well, first, I guess this slide, which is just ExxonMobil's projection of future demand. So if this is what future supply looks like, and this is what not only ExxonMobil, but the International Energy Agency, the U.S. Department of Energy, and everybody else is saying future demand is going to look like, well, we have a bit of a discrepancy there, therefore a bit of a problem. Okay, so why is ASPO and why are so many independent analysts now saying that peak oil could be right around the corner? Well, this is a slide from the International Energy Agency, which is usually quite optimistic about future supply scenarios. But every once in a while, they let something slip, I guess. I don't know. But this is from a PowerPoint presentation by one of their petroleum analysts just a couple of years ago. And as you can see, the title is Supply Crunch, the Coming Oil Shock. And it mentions here that older oil fields are mature and declining. This is a very important point because not all oil fields are created equal. Some are giant or supergiant fields that produce several hundred thousand, even several million barrels of oil per day. But the vast majority of oil fields are much, much smaller. So there are about 120 giant, supergiant, megagiant oil fields that produce about half of all the oil produced in the world today, about 120 fields. Then the other half of the oil that's being produced comes from thousands of much smaller fields. So there's quite a range there. Now the problem is, all of those giant, supergiant fields were discovered in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and just a couple of them in the 1970s. We're not discovering those kinds of oil fields anymore. Therefore, new discoveries are of smaller fields, and the industry's forced to produce just about flat out. Now, this next statement was really amazing to see in an IEA slide. It says, global reserves have been overstated for political reasons. Fascinating. What are they talking about here? Well, of course, this goes back to OPEC in the early 1980s, which made a rule which said that member countries could extract and export oil in proportion to their reserves. Now, of course, OPEC countries are in the business of exporting oil. That's how they earn their money. They want to do that as much as possible. So this created an incentive for them to overstate their reserves. Did they do so? Well, let's look at the evidence. Here, 1984 to 1985, Kuwait goes from 63.9 billion barrels to 90 billion barrels. No significant new discoveries in Kuwait in those years. 2 years later, Abu Dhabi goes from 31 to 92.2, Iran from 48.8 to 92.9, and Iraq, not to be outdone by Iran, goes from 47.1 to nice round 100 billion barrels of oil reserves. Saudi Arabia, evidently disapproving of this practice, drags its feet, waits another couple of years, and then perhaps losing market share, decides to go from 170 billion barrels of reserves to 257.5. Now, whenever we read these numbers in newspapers, in media, they're always described as proven reserves, which is a term that has a technical meaning within the industry. But for the layperson, the term proven reserves conjures up the notion, understandably, that somebody is out there proving the existence of those reserves. There must be some global oil cop with a giant dipstick who goes out to check once a year that Saudi Arabia really does have 260 billion barrels of oil. Well, of course, there is no such entity. And in fact, for all of these countries and others too, including Mexico, actual reserves are a state secret. We're flying blind. Some of the most important numbers we could possibly have are completely opaque, unreliable. Now, the subject of production capacity. Currently, the world oil production capacity stands at close to 85 million barrels of oil per day. Now, that number varies, and it has to be continually sort of replenished by new production capacity. Why? For two reasons. First, we need new production capacity to meet new demand. Demand is increasing, especially in countries like China and India. But we also need new production capacity to offset declines in production from existing oil fields. Remember, most oil-producing countries today are past their all-time peaks and are in decline. So some other countries have to step up, produce more than they did last year, just for us to stay even. So altogether, this adds up to a considerable amount. This, in 2006, according to the International Energy Agency, the world needs to develop 6 million barrels a day of new production capacity. It'll have to do the same thing and just slightly more next year. And cumulatively, that represents a fair amount, 2008. By 2009, we will have had to develop more new oil production capacity than currently exists in Saudi Arabia and Russia combined, the two foremost world oil producers. Now, that's a tall order. Of course, the industry has been able to do this every year up to the present. But it's as though we're on a treadmill that's speeding up and the runner is starting to get a little tired. At what point will the industry no longer be able to create more new production capacity at sufficient rate to keep up with declines? That is the essence of the peak oil discussion. Now, Chris Skrabowski, who has just been here in Perth the last couple of days, I understand, who's the editor of Petroleum Review in London, is one of the most knowledgeable individuals in the world on the subject of oil production capacity. And just recently, he was asked about this, and he said, at the moment, roughly 28% of world production is coming from countries in outright decline and going down at roughly 5% a year. By 2010, this will rise to 40% of world production. There's the possibility that things could deteriorate much more quickly. My latest calculations show the world will develop 18.8 million barrels a day of new capacity in the next 4 years. That's a substantial amount of new production capacity. This means if all goes fully according to plan, which of course it won't, there will be 9.3 million barrels a day of new capacity, or just over 1.8 million barrels a day each year, to meet new demand, which we will need. So up to 2010, we can probably muddle through with high prices and restrained demand. There's always the possibility, however, of faster depletion and greater project delays, which would obviously make the situation worse. After 2010, however, the situation deteriorates rapidly with negative supply growth in 2011 and 12. We don't have any reliable data beyond 2012, but all the indications are that the situation would be getting worse quite quickly. Now, when Chris was pressed on this point, he replied, "I feel it's my duty, given the social and economic chaos peak oil will undoubtedly produce, to stick very closely to defensible assumptions. If you ask me, do I personally think we'll make it to 2010, my answer is probably no. Random factors in Murphy's Law more or less rule out everything running smoothly. This, however, is not analysis but gut feel and hunch. On the hunch basis, 2008 would probably be my answer, but 2010, my analysis." I don't think you're likely to get any more accurate view of when peak will occur than what I've just read you. Meanwhile, where are we, in fact? Well, this is a picture of recent global oil production. And as you can see, the blue line is real figures. The yellow line is kind of a smoothed average. And as you can see, over the last 12 to 18 months, we've been kind of in an oil production plateau. Even though prices are at record levels and demand, obviously, is high, actual production has been stalled out. Now, this is suggestive. It doesn't prove that we are, in fact, at peak right now. But it seems to me that we've entered the peaking period. Between now and, say, 2010, we may see some increases. We may get up to maybe 90 million barrels a day, possibly. But in effect, we are within the peak region now. Well, this subject is starting to come through the media in some respects. We're starting to see it discussed. One oil company, Chevron, is actually taking out ads talking about it. It has a website called willyoujoinus.com. Evidently, Chevron executives are concerned that as prices go up, the people of the world will start looking for someone to blame. And the oil companies will, of course, be at the top of many people's lists. So if we can tell the people of the world that, by golly, we're all in this together, we're out there looking for the stuff and it's getting harder. Actually, I was speculating about why Chevron was, you know, paying millions of dollars for this PR campaign. And then I was giving a talk at UC Berkeley to some graduate students on this subject. And I went through this little routine, showed this slide. And everyone in the audience, there were 15 students there in the room, and they were all in their late 20s, early 30s. But there was one gentleman who was obviously in his 60s. I didn't think anything about it. He came up to me afterward and introduced himself. He was the father of one of the graduate students, and he had asked if he could come and sit in. He happened to be the recently retired head of PR for Chevron Texaco. I asked him if he knew anything about this ad campaign, and he said, "Oh yes, I designed it." I said, "Well, you know, is my suspicion correct as to the motives for this?" And he said, "Oh yes." And he went on to say, "David O'Reilly, the CEO of Chevron Texaco, is actually very concerned about peak oil. He doesn't actually want to talk about it, but he's deeply concerned, and that's why we've done this ad campaign." Okay, Russia's energy minister declaring that one can say with certainty that the era of cheap hydrocarbons is over. Zhang Weiping, the chief economist of Chinese National Offshore Oil Corporation, saying that he expects oil to peak during the next 5 years. Business Week telling us that oil companies are at peak. Now, of course, the oil companies only control a small portion of global reserves now. Most are controlled by the national oil companies. But nevertheless, the oil companies themselves are at peak. And everyone's favorite petroleum geologist, former U.S. President Bill Clinton, has said, "We may be at a point of peak oil production." Thank you very much, Bill Clinton. And even the New York Times now is saying that this may be the case. So we are at an interesting point in history where it's clear the evidence is lining up, and yet policymakers, by and large, seem to be completely blind and ignorant with regard to this subject. And we appear to be headed into a situation for which we are very, very ill prepared, and the consequences are likely to be enormous. In just a moment, I want to talk about a little bit more about those consequences and what we can do about them, but we've reached the time for a stretch break. So here is Sue Dennett.
So, to get the oxygen going in your brain, could you please stand up? Feet a small distance apart under your hips. Left hand on your hip and your right hand. Nice deep breath. One more time, right across. Now some clapping.
Well, I don't know about you, but I feel better. Okay, so continuing to be a bearer of bad news, I have to tell you that there are two kinds of problems in the world. Easy problems and difficult problems, hard problems. Easy problems look like this. Every step along the way towards solving the problem, things are getting better. So the policymaker who's leading us toward the good outcome can be patted on the back every step of the way. But on the other hand, if we start going in the wrong direction, things start getting worse. They feel worse. There's immediate feedback. So we know we're on the wrong path and we switch over. That's an easy problem. Policymakers love easy problems. Here's what a hard problem looks like. Hard problems are typically ones that take a long time to address in the future. You know, the problem isn't here yet, but we have to prepare ourselves for it, and that's going to require some effort, investment, sacrifice perhaps. And we won't see the immediate reward for that. In fact, the reward will come later on. Maybe preparing for hurricanes is an example of a hard problem, as my relatives in Louisiana found out. So peak oil is an example of a hard problem. Why so? Well, that's the essence of what's come to be known as the Hirsch Report. Which was a very important report produced for the U.S. Department of Energy, published last year. Peaking of world oil production impacts mitigation and risk management. And by the way, this report was immediately buried by the Department of Energy. It wasn't on their website. It was on a high school website from Chula Vista, California, for months. Well, why so? Maybe it's because of the executive summary. Let me read you this is just the first paragraph of the executive summary of this 100-page report. It says, the peaking of world oil production presents the U.S. and the world with an unprecedented risk management problem. As peaking is approached, liquid fuel prices and price volatility will increase dramatically, and without timely mitigation, the economic, social, and political costs will be unprecedented. Now, here's the word unprecedented used twice in the very first paragraph of the executive summary. Now, I haven't read every paper produced by policymakers for policymakers, but it seems to me that this may itself be unprecedented, this use of words. Viable mitigation options exist on both the supply and demand sides. But to have substantial impact, they must be initiated more than a decade in advance of peaking. In other words, the market is not going to solve this all by itself. We know that high prices will create incentives for finding alternative energy supply, for using oil more efficiently, and so on. This is very true. But it won't work fast enough. We need to start 10 to 20 years ahead at a crash program scale of effort in order to avert what they call unprecedented social, economic, and political problems. That's a hard problem. Well, what are some of those alternative supplies that we might look to? Well, it doesn't look good. This slide is for the U.S., but the global situation is not that much different. Petroleum, foremost energy source, virtually all transportation running on petroleum. Natural gas, number two, a little better situation here in Australia for natural gas than we have back in the U.S., where we have a genuine natural gas crisis going on. Coal, next. But what we use coal for primarily is electricity production. We don't have very many cars and trucks that run on electricity. So that's not an easy solution there. Or same thing with nuclear power, produces electricity. Again, we don't have an electrified transport infrastructure. It would help if we did, by the way. Then this 6% slice here of renewable energy consists mostly of biomass. A lot of that is people just burning wood in their fireplaces. And then hydroelectric power. Here's solar and wind. And these are really minuscule fractions of the total energy portfolio globally, much less than 1%, which is unfortunate because these are renewable energies and there's considerable room and opportunity for growth of those. But where we're starting from is not a particularly good place. Now, what about alternative fossil fuels? Well, yes, there are enormous quantities of the stuff in places like Venezuela and Canada, but there are inherent problems in scaling up the production process. It's not just a matter of throwing more money at the problem. The tar sands of Canada, for example, require enormous amounts of natural gas and fresh water for production. They're currently producing 1 million barrels a day from the tar sands in Canada. Hopefully, 3 or 4 million barrels a day by 2025. But remember, we need 6 million barrels a day of new production capacity every year between now and 2025. So those 4 million barrels a day of new production capacity that we'll arrive at by 2025, that's not enough to make up for a single year's new needed capacity. It's not going to turn things around. We could say something similar about the heavy oil of Venezuela. Gas to liquids. We can make very good liquid transportation fuel from natural gas. We're already using natural gas for a lot of other things, and the demand for natural gas is increasing. Adding a major new use for natural gas could overwhelm current supplies. And of course, natural gas is also a depleting non-renewable fossil fuel. When is peak natural gas globally? We don't know. Some estimates say possibly as soon as 2010 or 2020. How about coal to liquids? Lots of coal in the world, enormous amounts of coal. Some people say hundreds of years worth of coal. Well, of course, that's assuming current rates of use, and it's assuming that we can get all of that coal out of the ground and use it. When we actually take into account the variability and quality of oil and the fact that that rates of consumption are increasing, there's the possibility we may still see peak coal in only 30 or 50 years. Nevertheless, what about turning coal into liquid fuels? Can be done. It's being done in South Africa right now. They're producing about 150,000 barrels a day, the Sasol Corporation. I visited the Sasol Corporation last year and sat down with their executives and asked them about their future. They were quite happy to hear about peak oil, by the way. It turns out that China is currently buying enormous amounts of this technology. The problem is that we're starting with a low-grade fossil fuel with coal, much less energy dense than oil. Then gasifying it and then turning the gas into a liquid fuel, that entails about a 40% energy penalty for those processes. So we'll have to mine and transform enormous amounts of coal to yield relatively modest amounts of liquid fuels. Obviously, the environmental implications are horrendous. And also the practical matter of investment in vast new coal mining and transportation infrastructure. Renewables, of course, that's what we'll end up with at the end of the day. 100, 200 years from now, human beings, as they have been for tens of thousands of years we'll be relying on renewable sources of energy. Well, why not just go straight there? Not a bad idea. But, of course, as we've just seen, most renewable sources of energy give us electricity. The exception is biofuels, and there's great interest in biofuels in the U.S. right now. Senators and representatives lining up to pass bills to subsidize ethanol, especially and biodiesel to a certain extent. Of course, biofuels are plagued by low net energy yield. It takes energy to get energy, as we said early on. With oil, the net energy yield has been astronomical historically, 50 to 1, even 100 to 1 in some cases. With biofuels, we're looking at less than 1 to 1, 1 to 1, maybe 1.5 to 1. Very difficult to replace oil with biofuels and expect to run modern industrial societies. But even more worrisome is the trade-off with food production. We need arable land for both. And as the market for food crops to be turned into fuel grows, there's every incentive to farmers to grow fuel crops instead of food crops. So what does that leave us with? Conservation. And while most political leaders shy away from talking about this very much, they much prefer just to see substitution. This is where we'll have to look primarily for our responses to the problem of peak oil. Conservation itself is not a panacea. It takes investment and it yields diminishing returns over time. Nevertheless, in almost every instance, conservation is going to be cheaper by far than substitution. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means we're going to have to rethink how we use energy and how we use fossil fuels throughout our society. Agriculture, extremely important, because agriculture currently is overwhelmingly dependent on oil for running tractors and other farm machinery, for petrochemicals, pesticides, herbicides, for transporting food, and so on. So we have to rethink agriculture from the ground up, quite literally. Oil-free agriculture, organic, local, growing your own as much as possible. And then transportation. Usually when the subject of transportation and peak oil comes up, people's immediate thought is, well, what can we substitute for gasoline, for petrol in the tanks of our cars? That's the wrong question to ask. Over the short term, maybe that's what we have to ask. But the real question is, what are the most efficient forms of transportation that we can use? Because the automobile is an inherently inefficient form of transportation. And the fact that we've become dependent, so dependent on automobiles, is a problem in itself, and that is a problem that we have to address. Now, in places like North America and Australia, where we have become so dependent on cars and public transportation options often don't exist, we will be forced to use existing roads, highways, and vehicles in a much more efficient way. I can imagine using some of those big SUVs in the U.S. as taxis, you know, packing people in with, you know, with using cell phone technology and with flexible routes, so people could get where they actually need to go, but they'll be packed in with six or eight other people. And finally, what I'd like to talk to you about is the oil depletion protocol, which is the subject of my new book. And I think it's, from a policy standpoint, could be an extremely helpful way of approaching the problem of peak oil. The oil depletion protocol, very simple agreement for countries to both produce less oil and export and import less oil. Now, why would they want to do that? Well, because if we don't deliberately reduce our oil consumption, the result will be not just very high oil prices, but extremely volatile oil prices. And that in itself is an enormous challenge, because we need stable prices as an environment in which to make the kinds of, perhaps in some cases, risky investments that we will have to make in new energy technologies and efficiency and so on. If we don't know whether oil is going to be $50 next year or $300, then people are going to shy away from making those investments, governments, industries, and so on. So we need stable prices, and the oil depletion protocol can help us arrive at stable prices, high but stable prices. Also, it will reduce competition for oil around the world. And competition could lead, in fact, to conflict. We could see oil wars, civil wars over control of wealth from oil. And those kinds of conflicts could completely undermine the process of the energy transition globally. So what chance does the oil depletion protocol actually have of being implemented? It would seem like a really tough sell. Well, in fact, I think it has a very excellent chance, at least in some countries initially, and eventually, I think, for the world as a whole. Now, already Sweden has vowed to become oil-free by the year 2020. So Sweden is, in effect, signing up to the oil depletion protocol, even without having been asked to do so. Same with Iceland, same with Cuba. Now, Kuwait is an interesting case because in the Kuwaiti parliament currently there's a debate going on. Members of the Kuwaiti parliament have heard the rumor that maybe their country's oil reserves are only half what's been published. It's interesting that the members of the Kuwaiti parliament don't have any better idea of how much oil is in the country than we do. talk about state secrets. So anyway, the direction of this debate is, well, if in fact we have much less oil than we've been told, shouldn't we voluntarily reduce production so that we can save some of this valuable resource for future generations? So Kuwait is actually talking about, again, abiding by the terms of the protocol without ever having heard of it or having been asked. Then there are the declining producers, whose rates of decline in some cases are 5, 7, 8, 10% a year. They're already abiding by at least that part of the protocol's terms. Again, involuntarily, but why not make a virtue out of necessity? If your production's already declining, why not sign on to the protocol and do a good deed? And then there are the poor nations of the world that simply can't afford to import oil at current prices. So their imports are declining, again, exactly what's asked for under the terms of the protocol. Total all of these nations together, and we're up to almost half the countries in the world. So does the protocol have a chance? Well, maybe so. Meanwhile, there's the possibility of implementing the protocol at lower levels of government, even if nations like maybe the U.S., for example, or maybe Australia, who knows, balk at adopting the protocol at the national level, it could be adopted at the municipal level. And already in cities across the U.S. and in other places around the world, there are efforts underway to do something like that. Excuse me, I just lost my... Now, I'm not sure how to get this back on. It's been beeping for the last couple of minutes, so... Uh-oh. We've reached peak PA. Ah, good. It's back. So, for example, San Francisco, California, and Bloomington, Indiana have passed peak oil resolutions.
No illumination.
Well, that'll come in a moment, have passed peak oil resolutions in which they explicitly endorse the oil depletion protocol. So there's some nice efforts going on in that arena. And finally, you don't need to see the slide, I'll describe it to you. There's the possibility of personal implementation of the oil depletion protocol. Any individual anywhere in the world can total up how much oil they're using right now, keep track of how many liters or gallons of petrol are going into your gasoline tank every year, how many miles or kilometers of air travel you're doing every year, what kind of food you're eating, is it locally grown or is it imported from far away, and so on, and figure out pretty accurately just how many barrels of oil consumption you're responsible for, and then plan to use 2.6 to 3% less with every passing year. That can certainly be done. Actually, for most people in industrial countries, a full 10 years reduction of 25% could be done in the first year with very little pain. So, still no, well, that's okay. I'm at the end here. So, the problem facing it is facing us is enormous. There's no doubt that peak oil is probably the greatest challenge that we have faced, at least since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and possibly in all of human history. That's not an exaggeration, really. We do have the policy tools, I believe, to engage it. There are a few courageous policymakers who are taking this seriously, a few in the U.S. House of Representatives, here and there, a member of Parliament. The word is getting out. There is increasing concern about this among the general public, but we have enormous work to do. So I'm very glad that each and every one of you is here tonight, and I hope that you'll come away with this meeting with ideas of things that you can do in your own life. Thank you very much.